Justified by faith, hopefully. Yeah, there we go. Before I begin, just a quick notice. In a few weeks' time, I'm speaking at a day conference. It's on the theme of prayer. It's called Whatever You Ask, Rebuilding Our Confidence in Prayer. So if you fancy a whole day of teaching on prayer, it's at Thatcham Baptist. Now, there is a cost, and it's quite steep, but the cost goes down if we get a few people going. If there's three or four, it drops quite dramatically. Now, you might say, why would I pay to hear Chris when... when I can hear him for free? And you see, the thing is, I can only speak for 30 minutes here, but here I'm speaking for 4.5 hours. So, yeah, I was expecting a few comments at that point. Right, get that off there. Dave, I just want to tell you.
Tell me.
You're going to be okay.
Thanks, bud.
You're going to be okay. Is that good? Is that good news? You're going to be okay, Grace. You're going to be okay. Yeah. How do you feel about that?
Delighted.
Yeah. You're glad everything's sorted out? Fixed? Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, that went well, didn't it? You know, if someone came up to me and said, you're going to be okay, I'd find that slightly strange, wouldn't I? Unless I knew there was something wrong. And if there's something wrong and someone says, you're going to be okay, then that's fantastic news, isn't it? That's amazing news. And that's actually what Paul has been doing. He's been, you know, we may say, are we all right? Paul's saying you're not all right. He's not saying you're all wrong. You know, there's lots of good things about us. We're made in God's image and so on. But God says, Paul says, you may not be all wrong, but you're not all right. There is something at the heart of humanity that is not quite right. And it's a lot more serious than we realize. Our situation reminds me of a man who went to the doctors. He thought he just had a lingering cold that wouldn't go away. And so he went, he had an appointment. The doctor examined him. The doctor said, I'm really sorry, sir. It's a lot more serious than you've imagined. The doctor said, in fact, I'm not sure you've even got long to live. He said, I think you've only got 10. At this point, the man, 10 years, 10 months? And the doctor said, 9, 8. So it was a lot more serious than the man realized. And I'm afraid that's exactly what Paul has been telling us through Romans. You have a problem. Well, I know I've got a bit of a problem. And Paul says, no, it's a big problem. It is a major problem. And it's you have a fatal condition, a fatal illness. And that problem is that humanity, as we have heard many times, has made that decision of turning its back on God. We have rejected him in favor of ourselves. And that results in it results in sin. And you know, sin is awful, and we can point at, oh, that sin is terrible and that one. But the sin itself is, yes, that is part of the problem, but the fundamental problem is that rejection of God. That's where sin comes from. It's that rejection of our Maker. So we have an issue here, and that's why, as we heard last week, we're caught in the power of sin. Sin traps us, it holds us, it sets about slowly destroying us, it destroys the lives of those around us. And that is why, as we heard the week before that, God is angry. We say God isn't angry because he hates the world, God is angry because he loves the world. And when he sees how we treat one another, when he looks at human injustice and human evil perpetrated one to the other, God, of course, feels angry about that. So in a sense, over the past 2 weeks at least, we haven't painted a very pretty picture. In a courtroom sense, we're all standing in the dock. We're standing guilty, guilty of sin, you might say, with no hope, no prospect of rescue. And into that situation, Paul speaks two words right at the beginning of our passage. And those words are, but now. But now. And that is the hinge, that is the turning point where Paul moves from judgment to justification, or if you like, from condemnation to salvation. And that brings us to our verses, which have been described as the heart of the whole book of Romans. Some have even said this is the most important paragraph ever written. So we've got the verses, we'll read them in a moment. Here are the headings, sir. The gift of God's righteousness, 3 qualities. The cross of Christ, 3 images. And a defense of the gospel, 3 prohibitions. Okay, three threes. This is homiletic heaven, isn't it? So, the gift of God's righteousness. Let's hear these words. But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There is no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Now, I don't know if you felt upset when I talked about sin and judgment and God's anger, but it's really clear from Romans that that is true. But what is also true, even more true, is that God is a God of immense love. God sees there's a problem, but his love is so profound that he has done something about the problem. He has resolved that problem by offering us a gift. And that gift, simply, is his righteousness. That is the gift that we need to resolve the problem that we're in. And I want to illustrate this now. Alex, would you come up? And Peter, would you come up, please? And Josie, is Josie here? Josie, can you come up? Right, we've got our youth in the service today. Welcome, Peter. It's lovely to have you here. Peter's been coming to Friday Youth for years, haven't you? Yeah. So, right. Josie, could you hold that? Okay. Yeah. Josie is... Josie is God, okay, and that is why she is holding the sign that says righteous. Peter. Peter is going to be Jesus, and he is also holding a sign that says righteous. Alex represents humanity, or you could say he represents himself. And he has the word sinful. And this is the situation we're in. God and Christ being righteous has been sinful. But something, what Jesus has done is something quite amazing. So, let me take that from you. So, you hold that now. Hold it up. So, what word can you see, Peter? Righteous. You see the word righteous. Jesus sees the word righteous. What do you see? Read that word.
Sinful,
okay? So what's happened is Jesus is bearing our... he is righteous, he sees that, he is innocent, but when God looks at Jesus on the cross, he sees our sinfulness, and then just pass that to Alex, just like that, that's it. And hold that up now, that's it. What word do you see, Alex?
Sinful.
What word?
Righteous.
And so what's happened here is, yes, we know that we're not innocent, we're still guilty. But actually, God sees the word righteous because Christ has given us his righteousness. There's an exchange that's gone on here of sin and righteousness. Thank you. Thank you. And this righteousness from God has three qualities. The first one is that it is by grace. Dave's talked about grace. The grace is by grace because Paul says it's apart from the law. If we could get God's righteousness by being good, then Paul would say it is through the law. But it's not. It's apart from it. It's separate to it. So it is a gift of grace. So we don't get God's righteousness by being good, by doing the right things, or obeying the Ten Commandments. And I think there's a very common understanding in our culture that we get to heaven by being kind to our neighbors or giving to charity or on balance being more of a good person than a bad one. But actually, what we see in Romans here is that our righteousness just is not good enough. It is not up to the task. We need God's righteousness, and it's undeserved. We can't earn it. And I think this is a message which is unique to Christianity. You know, the world's religions tell us we will be saved by doing our best. Christianity says we're saved because God did his best. They say that we have to try to ascend up to God, probably on a path that's paved with good works. But Christianity says God descended to us and did the greatest good work of all by dying on the cross for us. So this gift of God's righteousness is apart from the law, it's by grace. Secondly, it's through faith in Jesus Christ. Our title today is Justified by Faith. In a way, I wished I could have called it this. Justified by Faith in Jesus Christ. That's the point, isn't it? Faith isn't going to save you on its own. The whole point of faith is, what's your faith in? And you could put your faith in all sorts of things. It could be horribly misplaced. I could put my faith in my dog if I wanted to. I could say, well, I'm going to trust Bailey. Bailey's going to help me. He'll get me through life. He'll save me. And he's a strong dog, but he's not up to that sort of responsibility. I know it's a silly, silly example. Okay, so as I've said before, everyone on this planet lives by faith. We all put our faith in something. Who or what can bear the weight of your faith or your hope? Who is the one who can bring you safely to salvation? And that is Jesus Christ. It's through faith in Jesus Christ that we get this righteousness from God. And thirdly, it is for all who believe. It's for all who, but God doesn't have favorites, okay? There's no inside track on God. It's for all of us. He loves the best of us and the worst of us equally. Here is how St. John Stott puts it. He says, the harlot, the liar, the murderer fall short of God's glory, but so do you. Perhaps they stand at the bottom of a mine and you on the crest of an Alp, but you are as little able to touch the stars as they. Okay, so we're on a level playing field when it comes to this. We are all in equal need of God's righteousness. But how can God do it? You know, we've just seen at the front here, Peter giving Alex that gift of righteousness, and in return, he gets sinfulness. It doesn't seem fair. How can God, who is a God of justice, look at that and say that that is just and right? How can he give us this gift? And that brings us to the cross of Christ. Let me read these words, verse 24 to 26. And all are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness, because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time, so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. Three words I want to pick out of this. There's the first one, justified. So we've got that term justification, a bit of a long word. It's a word that comes from the law courts. Let me share a story to illustrate it. There was a judge who one day had to try a case. And when the person came into the dock, he realized he knew this, but it was an old friend of his. And he heard the facts of the case, and it was evident that his friend was completely guilty. So he had to pass judgment, and he had to issue a fine. But having issued the fine, he took off his wig and his robe, and he stepped down from the bench and stood in the dock, got out his wallet, and gave the man the money for the fine. Was the man innocent? No. Was justice served? Yes. The penalty was paid by the judge himself. And that is a bit of a picture of what it means to say that we are justified. Here's that Sunday school expression, I guess. Justified means just as if I'd never sinned. Okay? If you're a Christian here, you're justified. It does not mean you're innocent. Okay? It doesn't even mean God could describe you as righteous. Because we're not, in many ways. And we know it's a process. And we have a different word for that. We call it sanctification. Justification is not a description of us. It is a declaration that God speaks over us. It's like he says, I declare you righteous because you have the gift of my son's righteousness because of what he has done at the cross. So God declares us guilty, but then he takes off the wig and the robe and he pays that penalty for us. And then he says, you're righteous. Second word, redemption. It's another longish word. It's a commercial term from the marketplace. And in Paul's day, this word was especially used in terms of freeing slaves. You know, it's about buying a slave, not so they can be your slave, but so you can set them free. And That's redemption. There was once a violin that was being sold at auction, and it was old and dusty and broken, and so the auctioneer was having a terrible time trying to sell it. He kept dropping the price. Nobody was putting their hand up. No one was interested. He got right down to 50 pence. Nobody wanted it. And then this old man shuffled from the back, came forwards, and he took a handkerchief out of his pocket, and he began to clean the violin, cleaned it up. And then he tuned it, and then he played it, and people were transfixed at the beauty of the melody that came from that violin. And they said, "How did you do that?" He turned it over. He said, "You see this plaque on the back of the violin and that name?" He said, "That's my name." He said, "I made this violin. Someone else has had it, and they have misused it and abused it, but I can fix it because I'm its maker." Now, in a sense, that man owned that violin twice. He owned it because he made it, and he owned it because he bought it back. And that's a picture of what God has done for us. He's made us. We have that plaque, if you like, that says that we're made in the image of God. But he has also bought us back. We've been, if you like, used and abused. Sin has used and abused us. But God says, "I'm going to buy you back. And I'm going to clean you up. And I'm going to make you what I want you to be, with the music I want to see in your life." That's a lovely picture of redemption. And that came at the cost of the cross. And then we have atonement, the sacrifice, as a sacrifice of atonement. Atonement speaks of being reconciled. You know, when two parties are at enmity and they're brought together, they're reconciled. Atonement, I like to think of it as at one meant. You know, things being brought together at one. And this takes us back. This is from the sacrificial system, language of sacrifice. And on the Jewish Day of Atonement, amongst other animals, the people would bring two goats. And one of them, the unlucky one, would be sacrificed. And the high priest would take the blood of that goat and he would pour it on the cover, the lid of the Ark of the Covenant, what's called the mercy seat. And that was to cover the sins of the people. And then he'd go out and he'd take the other goat and he'd lay his hands on its head. And as he was holding this goat's head, he would confess the sins of the people, all the different sins of the nation. And then that goat would be taken by someone into the wilderness and set free. And it was a picture. The first goat showed that God has dealt with our sin. And the second one, he has taken it away. He has removed it from us. And that, again, that is a picture of what Jesus has done for us. Hebrews brings this out beautifully. Let me read this. "But when Christ came as high priest of the good things that are now already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not made with human hands, that is to say, is not a part of this creation. He did not enter by means of the blood of goats and calves, but he entered the most holy place once for all by his own blood, so obtaining eternal redemption. For this reason, Christ is the mediator of a new covenant, that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, now that he has died as a ransom to set them free from the sins committed under the first covenant." Okay, so Jesus has atoned for sin here. And as he did that, you can see here, I think, is the word forbearance? Forbearance, third line from the bottom. God in his forbearance had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. In other words, the cross doesn't just save in the present or the future, it reaches into the past. If it hadn't done that, then all those saints of the Old Testament would not be saved. They would not have eternal life with God. But the cross reaches through time, past, present, and future. So Jesus is the perfect sacrifice and therefore can bring atonement. Let me finish with these verses. "Where then is boasting? It is excluded. Because of what law? The law that requires works? No, because of the law requires faith. For we maintain that a person is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. Or is God the God of Jews only? Is he not the God of Gentiles too?" Yes, of Gentiles too. "Since there is only one God who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through that same faith. Do we then nullify the law by this faith? Not at all. rather we uphold the law. Just want to bring out 3 points, and I'm just going to say probably 2 sentences about each. First one is, what we've been hearing means there is no boasting. We cannot sit here this morning and feel pleased with ourselves or smug about ourselves or think, look how good we are. We're so much better than those people up there in Cafe Nero right now, because we're here and, you know. There is no place for boasting, because the salvation we have is not our achievement. It's God's achievement. What did we contribute to our salvation? And the answer is nothing. In fact, what you could say to me is our sin. We contributed nothing at all of value. We contributed our sin, so we can't boast. Secondly, we can't discriminate. God is not just the God of the Jews. He is God of Gentiles too. And so no one has that inside track on God. We all come by faith, not by our religious heritage, not even by Christendom. Okay, we come by faith. And thirdly, we can't set aside God's law. You might say, well, if we're not saved by keeping the law, why do we need the law? It's no use. And Paul will talk a lot about this in Romans. But you see, yes, the law can't save us, but the law has a purpose, because the law shows us what righteousness looks like, doesn't it? This is what righteousness is. And so the law has value for sanctification. But in terms of justification, the law just points at us and says, you've failed, you've missed the mark. Right, let me apply this to ourselves. I just want to simply ask these questions. Is this our belief? And is this our behavior? Do you believe this? Do you believe we have a fundamental problem with sin and that the diagnosis for it is terminal? Now, in the past, church has talked about sin and judgment too much. And I think we've sort of reacted against that, and maybe that reaction was necessary. But we need to be careful that we don't react too far and that we lose the concepts of sin and judgment altogether. And the reason I say that is because grace doesn't mean anything. Grace doesn't mean anything without sin and judgment. It means nothing. Do you get that? It means nothing. In the words of John Newton, grace is amazing, amazing grace, he wrote, grace is amazing because we were wretched, lost, and blind, but through Jesus we're loved, and we are found, and we can see. So you see, if we lose the sense of what we're saved from, all we end up doing is cheapening grace. We're reducing it, we're minimizing it. And you know what? In the end, grace won't mean anything to us at all. So it's vital that we hold on both to what we're saved for, but also what we're saved from. The other thing I want to say, sorry, I feel quite strongly about my next point. If there is another way that we can get right with God, other than through what Jesus did at the cross, then please let's abandon the Christian faith. If there is another way that this can happen, that we can get this gift of righteousness, let's forget it. Why on earth would God, the Father, go through the pain and agony of sending his only Son to die on a cross for us if there's another way, another mechanism by which we can get to heaven? Why would he do that? It's vital we understand this. You know, hear me very carefully here. I don't know who's going to be in heaven, and you don't know either. We do not know. There may be Muslims in heaven. What I mean by that is there may be some people right now who live in Islamic countries. They don't really have access to the gospel, but they are genuinely reaching out to God. Maybe there'll be some Muslims in heaven. I don't know. Maybe there'll be some Hindus in heaven. Maybe there'll be some agnostics in heaven. We don't know. But what we do know for a fact from Scripture is nobody will be in heaven other than for the fact that Jesus Christ died for their sin, whoever they are. That is the only way that anyone will be there with God, because this is the way that God has brought righteousness to us. I hope you understand what I'm trying to say there quite clearly. Is this our behavior? If If we match our beliefs or judge our beliefs by our behavior, then we have to ask ourselves, do we really believe this? Is it issuing in actions in our lives? I have non-Christian friends, and some of them I know are quite hostile to the gospel. In fact, they've made that quite clear to me. And so I stopped sharing with them. And the reason I don't share with them is because I'm fearful. I'm fearful of the reaction that I might get if I speak to them about God. It would seem I'm more fearful about that than I am concerned for the fact that they need to get their lives right with God. Do I believe they need Jesus? Of course I do. I'd say that every day of the week. But do I believe it enough that I'm prepared to get over that barrier and just share with them anyway? So I think if we gain anything from Romans, I hope it is that we are more confident and passionate about the gospel. I think we need that as a church. I think I need it. We need to get to a place where we believe these truths, that this righteousness from God that's come to us, it's through Christ and through his death. We need to believe that passionately. Not just a belief, but the one that becomes our behavior that is lived out. I'm going to stop there. You've got postcards next to you or in your hands. Please use them well. And let's trust that God will do wonderful things as we lift up his son. Amen.